Welcome to Crime Wire, the place for information, news, and most importantly, justice. Our interactive website is www.crimewiresite.com. You can call in any time during the show by dialing 646-478-0982. And remember, you can participate in tonight's show simply by going to the live interactive chat room here on Block Talk Radio. If you are a friend or family member and would like to send CrimeWire information on an unsolved or suspicious death case or have a specific crime-related topic you'd like to have discussed on a future show, email us at thecrimewire@gmail.com. Kim Colton has the night off, and I'm honored to be joined on the switchboard by Delilah Jones. Hi, Dee.
Hi, Denny. I'm the one that's honored. I'm honored to be asked. I haven't been on your show in a long time. And
it has been a while. Well, welcome back.
Thank you.
And tonight our guest is Beverly Simcheck, author of the new book, Who Killed Chrissy? It's the story of two young women from Pittsburgh, Beverly and 23-year-old Christine Casilio, who went to Vegas in June of 1982 for a vacation and to check out employment opportunities. Just weeks later, on June 25th, Christine's body was found decomposing in the bathroom of her small studio apartment. The death remains unsolved to this day. Beverly was interviewed by Las Vegas Metro detectives at the time, but in the over 30 years since, she hasn't shared her knowledge of events surrounding her friend's death with the public until now. Beverly, welcome to the show.
Hi, Dennis. I'm glad to be here.
Probably before we get into the details, after all this time, after a little over 30 years, what made you decide to write the story?
Well, actually, I started writing the book 6 years ago, and it was at a time in my life when I had owned a business. My husband and I had owned a business for many years, and we lost the business due to the economy. So it wasn't, you know, exactly a big depression time, but it was time that we had to sit around and think and decide what we were going to do at that point. And I was a little lost, and I started thinking about it. I hadn't thought about it in decades. It was a haunting memory for me.
And today, 30-plus years later, do you still have the vivid memories? I mean, can you actually relive it?
Yes, I do, except that, you know, that's one of the reasons why it took so long to write the book was, you know, sitting and trying to pull out the memories. Anybody knows that writes memoirs that, you know, if a long period of time has gone by, that it's very, very difficult. You have to have a lot of silence, and you have to really, really try to dig out those memories and try to get things, you know, in order as best you can. So it was a very difficult process. And aside from also, you know, trying to find surviving family members that were no longer living in Pittsburgh, I had a very difficult task of researching the book. So it was an off and on thing. It wasn't like I wrote every single day for 6 years, but I had periods of time where I found information and then the trail would go dead, or, you know, I had a hard time following the trail. And I also did not want to have to go out to Las Vegas because, you know, the memories were so bad out there that I just didn't want to go out there. And I would have had to have gone by myself, which, you know, I vowed back in 1982 that I wasn't going to ever go back there unless I was with my husband. So, you know, it was a psychological issue for me.
And how long ago did the book actually come out? How long ago was it published?
It came out in October 2012.
And it's available on Amazon? Another
yes, it is. Mm-hmm. Paperback and Kindle.
Kindle. Now, let's stick with research just for a moment. When you were researching Now, obviously, the internet today allows you to do a lot of things without having to travel, but it doesn't let you do them all. Like you say, you can run into dead ends. You can, you know, the trail, something you're pursuing goes cold. And when you're a one-man, or in your case, a one-person operation, it is difficult, isn't it, to the research piece?
Oh, yes, because, you know, and, well, secondly, I'm not a family member. You know, Chris,
right.
Teen and I were friends, so I didn't have, you know, I didn't have the clout to pick up the phone and call and ask for reports, although I did that. And, you know, it's all in my book, what I went through, you know, first getting hold of the cold case people out in Las Vegas and then, you know, having them refer me to the coroner and the records departments and, you know, on and on and on. And there was absolutely, you know, I reached a dead end every single time. So, you know, and then, you know, the part about looking for the family members, you have to start from scratch and you have to call everybody in the phone book with that name.
Yeah, there were two aunts of Christine's or Chrissy's who are both deceased now, I believe. But they for a while, tried to keep this thing alive, didn't they? Tried to do some investigation.
Yes, as far as I know, they did. I didn't know them. She spoke of them when we had, you know, when we had lived together, basically in an old apartment building in Pittsburgh on Riverview Avenue, and we were neighbors. And she briefly told me things about her two aunts, Josephine and Angeline. That had raised her, and she really never gave me a whole lot of information about her mother. I assumed when I started the project that her mother was deceased, only because she never spoke of her. But her biological father was, you know, the brother to the aunts that raised her. And I knew that she had a sister and a brother, and that's basically all I knew. I didn't know much more than that.
And when you did your research, did you run into any surprises family wise?
I did. The first person that I found was her brother, and he was incarcerated when I found him. So I had to try to communicate, you know, with the Allegheny County Jail people. And he had been in and out of jail for, you know, minor things. I don't know what it was, DUIs, things like that. And, you know, but it was a clue that was given to me by somebody from the north side of Pittsburgh, which is where all of this took place. In fact, that's where I grew up, you know, on the north side of Pittsburgh, and that's where the Casilio family was from. So, you know, I proceeded from there, and through him, he was very hesitant to even put me in touch with his sister, who currently lives out east in Pennsylvania. But he wasn't sure that she was going to want to talk about it. As far as even, you know, finding out that there was a mother involved, I didn't find that out for years, actually.
And of the people, the family members that you have been actually in touch with, either with written communication or verbal, what has been the general reaction? Would you say pretty positive about what you're doing, negative or mixed bag?
As I try to explain in my book, it's difficult. It was very difficult for me. Although I spoke to her sister for quite a few times, we eventually became friends, but it was after a few years that she put me in touch with the mother, and, you know, so it went on from there. But it was not, I was never very clear on what they wanted. They were, I don't know how to explain it, they were probably burned out on the fact that they had spent a long time going after this themselves, you know, and trying to get answers for many, many, many years and getting nowhere. And I had to understand that, you know, when I was working on this book, because, you know, they really were, I can't say hesitant, but they were literally, you know, just, I don't think there's going to be any answers. You know, it was kind of like, you know, why are you bothering? You know, at this point, you're not going to find anything out.
But that didn't deter you. You continued through the end.
No, I did. And, you know, at a certain point in time, I almost gave up. I literally stopped writing. And I didn't think, you know, because in the genre of true crime, we all know that, you know, I did a lot of reading. It's my first book. I wanted to research, you know, certain books, you know, certain classics, whatever. And I understand I'm not, you know, one of those people that reads true crime. So, you know, I had to research this and find out what people were expecting of it. And, you know, and that scared me because, you know, I did not have a suspect. I did not have a murderer. I did not have a courtroom. I didn't have anything except an unsolved crime.
Okay, before we move on to some information about Chrissy and your trip to Vegas and so forth, I would just want to confirm officially, as far as the death certificate and the Las Vegas Metro Police Department are concerned, the status of the death is what? Is it still an undetermined or an inconclusive situation, or is it now a homicide?
No, it's still, to my knowledge, and like I said, I did finally, last year, I spoke to her biological mother, and she was participating for a while, but she's had, you know, she's been ill, she's had problems, and so she was on and off with it, but she did write a letter, she sent me a copy of the letter, she requested the death certificate, and when she got it, she told me that it was wrong, that's all she told me, and
okay.
She wouldn't tell me anything more.
Okay, now let's talk a little bit about Chrissy. What can you tell us about Chrissy and what you knew about her from Pittsburgh and that type of thing?
Well, I think, you know, at the time, Dennis, she was 23 years old. I was 32. So, you know, there was an age gap there. But we were, like I said, we both had apartments in the same building. So we were casual friends. We were not close friends, although we had, you know, we visited each other's apartments and we knew each other to a certain degree. But, you know, I did not know her for a long period of time before this happened. And it was just it was one of those youth things where, you know, I was, the company I was working for was going out of business and it was time to take a vacation, basically, you know, so we kind of made up the excuse that we were going to go out to Las Vegas and see if we were interested in relocating there. Again, we might find interesting jobs.
Okay, so the two of you agreed that a change of scenery, at least on a temporary basis, was in order. So you booked, what did you do, book a some kind of vacation package or just made your own reservations, or how did you set up your trip?
We bought one of those vacation packages for, I think it was Monday through Friday for 1 week, plus airfare at the, and, you know, rooms at the Holiday Inn on the Strip.
Okay. So
mm-hmm.
you were anticipating initially to be gone just for 5 days or so.
Exactly.
So in, what was it, June 1st, I believe, is when you actually caught the plane out of Pittsburgh to go to Las Vegas, and Chrissy had an issue, didn't she, and she had to come out on a later flight?
She had missed the plane, and I hadn't even realized that until, you know, until everybody was loaded onto the plane. But, you know, in those days, there were no cell phones. This was 1982. So I had to wait until the plane landed and go find a payphone to call her and find out why she missed the flight. And she had an issue with trying to find somebody to feed her cat while she was gone.
Okay, so that held her up. Now, how long before she was able to join you?
I think it was a couple days. Yeah, it was. You know, I had a big calendar up here in my office when I was writing this book, looking at the June 1982 calendar and trying to figure out the timeline. And trying to remember all the dates and all the how many days it took to do this and how many days it took to do that. It was interesting. It was challenging, let's put it that way, after all these years to try to put it together and, you know, how many days we were separated, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, I'm still not... I can honestly say I did the best that I could with that calendar, but, you know, all I know is that when, you know, when we got out there, it seemed like a short amount of time, and, you know, I can't tell you to this day if she had planned on going to the Holmes Cooney fights, that was her purpose, or whether it was something that just came up at the last minute. I don't remember that. I just know that she, when we got out there, she, you know, the Holmes Cooney fights were to go, I think, on the 11th or the 12th it was, for those fights, and at Caesar's Palace. And she decided that she wanted to stay for that because that was beyond the point that we had, you know, booked the package for the week.
Okay, now, prior to June of 82, had either you or Chrissy been to Vegas before?
I had not. However, during the research process, in speaking with one of her ex-boyfriends, who just happened to, you know, I found him here in Pittsburgh, and he actually lives close to where I live. So I went over there and spent, I don't know, 2, 3, 4 hours, you know, talking to him. And he was very receptive, and, you know, he turned out to be somebody that was really, you know, interested in it, and he helped me out a lot. But he had informed me that she had gone out there with him. He was in the insurance business, and she had gone out there with him, you know, previously, probably a year before that, 2 years before that, when they were dating, and that she had problems. You know, that she had left the car and got up in the mountains and got lost. And, you know, that was the kind of person that she was. She was an adventurous explorer type person who did what she wanted to do.
Okay, so even though Chrissy had been to Vegas herself previously, as far as you know, she didn't have any close friends there or family there?
No, and I was not aware. At the time that her and I went to Vegas, I was totally unaware that she had ever been there. She never spoke that to me. She never informed me that she had ever been there. Or if she had, and, I don't remember.
And what was her, you had mentioned the boyfriend she had visited Vegas with, the insurance business guy. What was, in Pittsburgh, what was her social activity like? I mean, did she have a lot of boyfriends or
She had a busy social life. Yeah, she did. She had several boyfriends, and she dated a lot of different people. The two prominent people being Chucky and Marty, who was a Pittsburgh cop. And those are the only two people that I ever encountered, you know, and, or, well, actually, I never even encountered only Chuck, the one guy, you know, that I had met on one or two occasions when he came over to pick her up to go to dinner. Her other boyfriend, Marty, who was a Pittsburgh cop, I had never met him. I didn't meet him until the funeral.
Kate, was she going or seeing either of them or both of them at the time of your trip to Vegas?
I believe, or at least this is what Chuck told me, and I think it's probably true because I do not remember him being in the picture at that time. I believe it was Marty who she was still seeing, and I think he, you know, I think she knew him for a long period of time since she was a young teenager from the North Side. But he was the one that she got to, you know, feed her cat while she was out in Las Vegas, and he had a key to her apartment.
Mm-hmm. And you say he was at that time a Pittsburgh police officer?
Yes.
Okay. So now you're in Vegas. You're there. Chrissy shows up a day or two later because of the cat incident. Were you having a good time? Were you enjoying Vegas?
Well, I think we were trying. At least I was trying to have a good time, but she was aggravated. She had, you know, when she arrived, she was aggravated. She was angry. She was on the phone all the time. We had separate rooms, of course, so I didn't, you know, the only time that I experienced her frustrations were, you know, when we were having dinner in the buffet line at the Holiday Inn. We were, at that point, starting to not get along because, you know, she was flighty. I mean, she was a very flighty person, and I was the kind of person that was just there to be, to have some kind of enjoyment with sunshine and a little gambling.
And Denny, just real quick, do you know why she was angry, why she was so aggravated, and do you also know who it was she was going back and forth on the phone with? Was that the person who was getting her agitated?
Yeah, I cannot tell you that at that point in time that I knew a whole lot what was going on with Marty, but I think that, you know, later on, when I witnessed the conversation with her screaming at him on the phone because of, you know, the cat got out of the house or something, but I think a lot of it revolved around Marty, who was not doing what she wanted him to do in Pittsburgh while she was in Las Vegas. That's my assumption.
And that was just kind of putting the damper on her whole mood while she was there?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I mean, it could have been something else. I don't know. But like I said, we were not really close friends. You know, I've had close friends in my life. You know, Chris and I were not, I think because of the age gap and because of, you know, my maturity level, I was, you know, I fluffed a lot of it off, a lot of her behavior, and at the time, I think that she was there for her purposes, whatever, you know, whatever she was looking into, you know, she had it in her mind that she wanted to buy a health club.
Okay, so she had an agenda that may have been different from yours.
I think so.
Did she also gamble a little bit? I mean, would that be the type of thing she would also do while you guys were?
Yeah, we did, but you know, I don't think there was a big interest level there for her. I think she was, you know, because she was one of those people that jogged and worked out and went to the gym and rode bicycles all the time, which, you know, I did not do. I did not do any of that. So, you know, that was her forte. And, you know, a few times we went, you know, after we left the Holiday Inn, when the package ran out, she found a studio apartment within walking distance of Caesar's Palace. And that at that point, you know, we both decided to stay longer.
Did Caesar's Palace, was that somewhere you just happened to go? It seems like that was kind of one of your main focal points, you know, to hang out at or to visit. Mm-hmm. Was there any special reason for that or just?
Well, I think because
it was a nice place.
It was a nice place. I think because the fights were coming in, and, you know, there's always some big event going on at Caesar's Palace, and the Holmes-Cooney fights were coming in there. And there were a lot of movie stars walking around the property all the time. you know, people were arriving, coming and going and getting ready for the fights. And I think that, you know, that created the excitement, the, you know, going there and seeing and having a glimpse of somebody famous.
And up till this point now, for your first few days there of your trip, did you get the sense that anybody that Chrissy was communicating with was somebody she knew from the past, or was this all just contacting with strangers who happened to be in the same place at the same time?
Do you mean in Las Vegas, or do you mean?
Yeah. No, in Vegas, did you have the sense that she knew previously, knew any of the people you'd bumped into or talked with? Or
No. Not at all. No.
So this was all stranger contact.
Yeah, and remember, like I said, there were no cell phones, you know,
right,
back then. So people didn't walk around with cell phones. If you were to talk on the phone with someone from Pittsburgh, you had to go to a payphone, or you used the phone in your apartment or your room. So, you know, any time that we were in the studio apartment, I was there. If I was there, I could overhear a conversation. But, you know, any other time, if she was doing any communicating with anybody on the phone, I wouldn't have been there, or I wouldn't have known, because she would have had to have gone to a payphone.
And you say this studio apartment was close to Caesar's Palace. Do you remember what street it was on, by chance, or the name of it?
Is it East Flamingo? East, I think it's East Flamingo, 700. Yeah, it's still there today. It's still there
today,
Dennis.
The Woodridge apartment?
Woodridge, but I think it's called the Swenson or the Siegel Suites, something like that.
Okay, yeah.
It looks the same, yeah. I had a friend that was out there, snapped some photos of it for me before I published the book. And, you know, it was kind of odd seeing them, but, you know, and you can also pull the complex up on the Google map, which I did a few times. It pretty much looks the same.
And when you moved from the Holiday Inn, where your vacation package was, into this, at the time, the Woodridge Apartments, did you have to sign a lease or commit to any specific time frame, or could you leave when you wanted to?
No, they rented by the week.
Okay.
No,
so you,
yeah,
you didn't have to agree to a long-term or make a long-term commitment?
No. No, it's more of a motel atmosphere with, and I don't know what it's like today, you know, what they do there today, but, you know, back in 1982, it was more of a motel arrangement. The rooms were more like little studio apartments with kitchens, you know, little mini kitchens, and they rented them by the week.
Okay, and did you come to meet, and maybe you and Chrissy both, but at least you, somebody by the name of Kathy and Larry Roberts?
We did. I don't remember if Chris was with me at the pool that day at Caesars when I met these two people who were, I would say, probably in their mid to late 30s and were at the pool there. They were claiming they were visiting from Los Angeles and that they were there for a month, that they had rented a house in the suburbs. And so, you know, I started hanging out with them because Chris and I weren't getting along real well. And they liked to gamble. So, you know, I hung out with them and, you know, doing the slot machines and which, you know, from what I understood at the time, I think it was kind of a common thing for people to do that and hang out in groups and just move around the different places and play the slots, you know.
So, and did they seem to be big money people or just common?
No, not at all, Dennis. They were just, to me, seemed like regular people. They were nice. They were normal, or what I thought was normal. But I'm a Pittsburgh girl, so, you know, it's, you know, Pittsburgh's a really friendly town. And, you know, it's that's part of the intrigued that I, you know, when I was writing my book, I was just having, you know, having feelings about how friendly Pittsburgh has always been. And I've been, you know, I've lived in New York since then. I've lived in Toronto, my son's father being an entertainer. So, you know, I still think that, you know, and of course I'll probably never go back to Vegas, but I just think that, you know, it's kind of a shock when you, you know, when you're out of Pittsburgh and you realize that people are not the same. They're not friendly. You don't know who you're talking to. You know, you don't, you know, you have this stranger danger thing going on. So,
sure.
But I thought they were friendly people. I really did. You know, I didn't think anything odd about them.
And did you come in contact with another fellow named Fred?
We both did. Fred was, now, according to him, you know, he was somebody that was hanging out at the pool at the Woodbridge Apartments, and, you know, just a lot of people were there every single day. But according to him, what he told us was that he was a prize fighter who was there from Philadelphia. And he was there to make money at the Holmes Cooney fights. They were having prize fights, and you know, I assume today that you know, that may or may not be true, because I have no way of knowing. I never saw the actual the crime report or anything else with any names on it. If I had had. You know, if I had access to Fred's last name today, I may have been able to track this down and, you know, find out where he is today. I mean, you know, he could be sitting in a jail cell. He could be a serial killer, you know, for all I know. But, you know, without any information, you can't go any further than what they had, you know, what the detectives had in their file. And I don't have a file. And to my knowledge, nobody does.
Yeah, we're going to talk about that in a few minutes. That's interesting.
What's the question? Excuse me, Danny. Beverly,
yeah.
What did Chrissy do for a living? Where did she get her income?
Well, when she was my neighbor in Pittsburgh, she was working for a company. I think it was Avon, one of those things, selling makeup and cosmetics, and that's all I knew. That's
mm-hmm.
all I really knew. I didn't know that, you know, what she had done previous to that, or, I mean, she's obviously, like I said, 23.
How much money would take to spend this kind of time in Las Vegas and go and rent an apartment and all of that? I mean, I'm sure if she was very successful with Avon and makeup and so forth, she could save her money. It just struck me as, where did her money come from?
Well, I can tell you that she had boyfriends, and mm-hmm. you know, she had suitors, she had boyfriends. But I, at 1982, looking back on it today, I guess when you look back on things like that, you say, you know, really may have seemed expensive at the time. But to my knowledge, you know, it was literally, you know, it was $100 a week for a studio apartment to stay over at Woodbridge Apartments. And, you know, and we split that, so it was $50, and it was, you know, I don't remember it being, you know, enormously costly, you know, and you know, meaning today you'd probably spend a lot more money going out to Vegas. But if you, you know, if you look at it on a scale of, you know, what it was like back then, or maybe it was, I don't know. I had a really good job in sales, so I made, you know, I was making at the time probably, at that time, probably $25,000 a year, which was considered a good amount of money. But I don't know, you know, I don't have any clue where she got her money. I have no clue.
Delilah raised a good point. I'll just follow up on that if I could. Did she take care of her own weight, though? I mean, did she pay her own way, or did she kind of let you pay for things?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So
yes,
she was self-sufficient.
Did.
Okay.
Yes. Yes.
She the spread guy who said he was a prize fighter and so forth, did he try to move in socially with either you or Chrissy, try to, you know, date or that type of thing?
No, not really, not at all. It was just it was very casual. You know, it was one of those things where, like I said, you're young and you know, you're meeting people at the pool, and there was not any kind of relationship going on. There was, you know, I was meeting people, she was meeting people, and nobody was having any kind of serious relationships, no.
Okay. Now, you indicated that your relationship with Chrissy started to deteriorate, if that's an appropriate word, or
mm-hmm.
become strained. That was basically what, because you guys were into different things, and she apparently had her own agenda that she was pursuing. Is that kind of why there was a strain on your relationship?
Well, I think so. I think, but I also believe that some of the things that were going on, you know, were shocking to me. You know, there was an incident at the pool where she, you know, like almost immediately when we moved into the Woodbridge Apartments, she had gone off with a stranger, and I don't know who that was, because I was at the pool sunbathing. I don't remember this. I describe it in my book, you know, where she disappeared, and you know, when I was dozing off, and when I woke up, I saw security running, and you know, and then she appears back on her tile next to me and describes this scene where she had gone to the room with somebody supposedly to give a body massage. And, you know, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, yeah, you mm-hmm. found some of this stuff a little odd, probably.
Well, I don't know, Dennis. I can't, you know, this is the stuff that I ended up speaking to her sister about. You know, people can make all kinds of assumptions, and, you know, I don't know. I really, you know, was she a hardcore hooker? No. I honestly can tell you no. She was a girl from Pittsburgh. She had some kind of dreams. She had, you know, she was very, very much into working out at the gym, lifting weights. She did professional body massage. I don't know that she, you know, she was like a trained masseuse type person, which to me is a very, you know, yes, in Pennsylvania you have to be licensed. I don't know if she was pursuing that or not, but she had all intentions of doing this with a legitimate health club in her mind. That's what I knew, you know.
Okay. There came a point then where your relationship with Chrissy was in such a state that she decided she wanted her own apartment.
Yes. And
tell
us
a little bit about that, how that came about.
So you want to hear the story of, well, I mean, basically what happened was I woke up too early one morning. My alarm went off, and, you know, it woke her up, and she did not want to get up that early, and she flipped out and said, you know, she started screaming and going berserk and packed her bags right there on the spot and said, I'm leaving, I'm out of here, I'm getting my own place. She left me in shock. You know, I wasn't expecting it. And she went out and she left it in, you know, a high state of anger. So I really didn't, you know, immediately have the desire to go find her, you know.
Yeah.
I was left there, and I, you know, I'm thinking, well, you know, should I stay another couple of days? Should I, you know, just take advantage of the sunshine, et cetera, et cetera, and, you know, and wait a little while. And Somebody made a comment. I can't remember what it was on. Somebody I was talking to was asking me about that period of time. It's very hard to remember how many days went by, you know, the exact number of days. The only dates that I really had in my mind, you know, the day that she moved out was, it was before, no, it was after the Holmes-Cooney fights, which I knew the date for that. You know, it was almost immediately after that. And then, you know, from that point on, I don't know what the period of time was before I said, you know, I was starting to worry about her because I had not seen her around the apartment complex.
Okay, so let's just say that the Holmes-Cooney fight was the 11th of June. She moved out, you know, possibly the 12th or 13th, shortly
mm-hmm.
afterward. Between her moving out and the 25th of June, which we'll get to the events of the 25th of June in a minute, but during that maybe 10-day or so period, about how many times did you think you ran into her around the complex or at Caesars or wherever?
I didn't. I only saw her. She actually came to my – she came and knocked on my door. And she had photographs of that this guy Fred had taken, which he had also told us that he was making extra money taking Polaroid photos at Caesar's Palace, you know, of people, and she had a whole envelope full of photographs that he had taken of us dressed up at the fights and, you know, various things in the lobby of the hotel, et cetera, et cetera. And she knocked on my door and, you know, she had this big packet of photographs that she wanted to show me. She was all excited about it and said that Fred had given her these. I looked at them and I was not in the kind of mood where I was thinking I cared about them. I looked at them and said, you know, I really don't think there's anything great in here. I don't care about them. And I think I was still very angry with her for what she did, you know. And basically she said fine and she walked away. And that was the last time I saw her alive.
So that from the time she moved out through June 25th, you saw her and talked to her basically once?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yes.
You said there became a time after she'd moved out where you became a little bit concerned about her. You weren't bumping into her or seeing her around. Was that around the 25th or close to the 25th of June?
I would have to say it had to be a relatively short time period because there weren't many days in there where I had gone, you know, looking for her because I had not. After she stopped by with the photographs, I heard nothing from her. And, you know, how long of a period went by, I don't remember. I don't have this calendar in front of me here. But I do know, you know, at a certain point in time, I went down to the front office and I asked them for the apartment number and went over to her, and they gave it to me, you know, because we had arrived there together. And I went over to, you know, the apartment where they said it, and it was kind of on the other side of the complex. So I thought, well, you know, this is why I'm not running into her, because she's coming and going in the other direction or whatever, you know, where there were shopping plazas over there and, you know, the health food store where she had, was riding her bike, et cetera, et cetera. So the... I went over to her apartment, and that's when the real mystery started. Was because, you know, when I went up on the front porch of the way the motel is, I looked in the front window and I saw because the drapes were open, and this was close enough to the date when they found the body that, you know, when I looked in there, all I could see was I could not see the bathroom from the front window, but I saw keys on the coffee table, you know, and I assumed that she was either there or had, you know, maybe had gone out for something. But, you know, I was puzzled because she had keys on, they were keys on the coffee table. I could see that the bed was not made, the bed was totally stripped, the comforter was off the bed. And so I thought she was in the laundry room. I went to the laundry room looking for her. And I, you know, I just assumed at that point that she was around somewhere. You know, a couple of days later, I went back there and the drapes were closed, meaning I was convinced at that point she was coming and going and I was missing her.
Let me ask you this, Beverly. Did there come any point, now obviously some of the people back in Pittsburgh certainly were aware that you and Chrissy had gone to Vegas together. Did you receive any phone calls in your room or anything from her family or the Smarty guy?
No.
Or anybody looking for her?
No. Mm-mm.
Okay.
No. Nobody ever called there. Mm-mm.
So now let's move to June 25th and tell us what transpired that day.
So we're talking. Oh, okay. The detectives after that point in time. The detectives came to my apartment and informed me that they had found her in her apartment in the bathroom, deceased. And, you know, I literally did not believe that because I know that just a few days before that, I had seen, looked in the front window and seen, you know, signs that she was coming and going. So it was a big shock for me because I didn't understand, you know, and they said she was decomposed. She had maggots. She had, you know, she was in bad shape, meaning we think she's been dead for over a week or we don't know how many days, but there, you know, the body was decomposing. So, and that was the other part of the mystery was, you know, the air conditioning was never on when I went over there. You know, they were the types of air conditioners where you could see, you know, if you were standing in front of the room, you could hear them and feel them. And, you know, there was air blowing out. And I thought that was strange.
Let's just follow up on that for a second, because for anybody who is not familiar with Las Vegas,
mm-hmm.
You get Las Vegas in mid-June.
Yeah.
It's hot. There's,
yeah.
It might be a dry heat and all that, but it's hot.
It's like 99, yeah.
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 And, mm-hmm. Most people in June, most people in businesses, are running air conditioning 24/7.
Sure.
Right? You know, that, mm-hmm. it's not the type of place you're going to be and just try to operate with a ceiling fan or something for your temperature control. And I'm trying to think of what circumstances someone alive and healthy and aware of what's going on would turn off their air conditioner in Las Vegas in June. And I'm having trouble coming up with an answer to that.
Yeah, me too. That was a part of the things I discussed with her ex-boyfriend, Chuck. You know, he told me, you know, Pittsburghers do have, you know, we have a, he said, well, you know, there were times when, back in Pittsburgh, when she would run in the park and sometimes, you know, Pittsburghers don't like air conditioning. Let's put it that way. We turn it on if we absolutely have to. Other than that, we prefer to have the fresh air in the windows. And, you know, it seems it's always been that way. And I understand that, except that I cannot believe at that time, you know, I knew, I even looked up the temperature from 1982 on those days. And it was in, you know, it was 98 degrees. So I can't buy that she would have turned that off herself. I just don't.
Okay, and did the police tell you what led them to finding her? Did someone call them? Did the maid or room service or something?
Well, supposedly, what they told me was that the maintenance man was changing a light bulb on the front porch and smelled an odor, which, yeah, and I didn't understand that either because I did not smell any odor when I was there standing on the front porch.
Okay, and they told you when the detectives called at your apartment that morning, they indicated to you they felt she'd been dead for possibly a week.
Yes.
Okay.
Meaning it would have been, it would have happened, you know, they were implying that she died right after the last time I saw her, which would have been around the 12th.
Okay. And yet you had seen, when you went to her apartment, you had seen evidence that of activity in the sense of the blinds being open and keys
yes.
and that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So,
mm-hmm.
so she apparently or somebody was there from time to time. And,
I have to believe that, Dennis. You know, that's something, you know, that has stuck with me for a long time, you know, that I have to believe somebody was coming and going in there.
Okay, so now the police have interviewed you or talked with you about what happened then. Did they take you to her apartment?
Yeah, they walked me over there, and, you know, there were people standing around when when the coroner got there and they brought the body bag out. You know, they said, you know, they interviewed me. They talked to me about the they wanted information. I gave them the information about Fred, you know, that we were both kind of hanging out with him and at the fights and that he, you know, apparently lived somewhere in the complex. And they also talked, you know, and they also asked me about Marty, her boyfriend in Pittsburgh.
Okay. Excuse me just a second. Delilah?
Yeah. I'm here.
I just noticed a call coming in from the 702 area. That would be Las Vegas. I wonder if we might have somebody
sure.
who knows something about this or has information or anything.
Okay, let me pull them in. Hello, caller.
Yeah, it's Manny, not in Las Vegas. I just had an idea hit me about those open curtains. And I wanted Denny maybe to question, was she possibly like in a bathing suit or something where people could see through? And someone, could this have been a sexual kind of assault and rape and murder kind of thing? It's weird that the curtains were open and somebody closed them. It just seems very, very strange. And
yes,
I was wondering
strange.
What Beverly thought.
Well, very good point, Manny. Thank you. And let's ask Beverly right now. Beverly, was there any evidence or did you ever hear or see any type of reporting that indicated there was a sexual assault involved with this?
I asked the only person left that may have, you know, asked her sister was in college at the time that this happened. We discussed, you know, when the aunts died, nobody knows what happened to the files, the boxes. There had to be something left that they kept all this information. Her sister, who's alive today, does not know what happened to any of those things. Or that's what she told me. You know, I think that she probably would have helped out if she had known anything about it. But the only way to know anything would be to have the file. You know, on what the detectives wrote in the file at that time. I only knew, you know, in fact, it was in the newspaper articles that the way she was found was naked from the waist down and a tank top and a jacket yanked up over her head and stuck there. And then, you know, she was hanging over the bathtub. Like sitting on the side of the tub and her head was submerged under the water with the comforter to keep it down in the water. The whole tub was filled up with water. And the comforter from the bed was in the water.
Well, Beverly, so, yeah, I agree totally with you with the files, certainly, to see the report.
Oh,
and
but
so
your
forth.
Question was, I'm sorry, about the sex. No, I I talked to Sarah Wecht, our local Pittsburgh coroner, who's very famous all over the world. And, you know, because he did a second autopsy when the body was sent back here to Pittsburgh. He said that, you know, of course, he didn't remember this. If he had had a copy of the report again, he would have been able to go over it with me. But nobody has that information. Nobody has those files. But what he said was that, yes, there should have been a rape kit done because of the nature of the crime, you know, and the way that she was found, that there should have been something, they should have tested for a sexual assault. But, if there's no record of the actual from the coroner's office, then, you know, I don't know where you would get that.
Are you saying, let me make sure I understand this, are we saying that even if the Las Vegas coroner's office had done everything according to Hoyle and done the rape kit and so on and so forth, that the records have disappeared?
Yes.
That, oh, my God. So we've got this dead girl and the police department, nobody has records.
Nobody has records.
How I don't understand how that can happen.
I don't either.
You know,
yeah,
that's why I asked
also, Vinny.
Huh?
That's why I asked the question, because of the Beverly's astute, looking and seeing the shades, not the shades, the curtains open and close, et cetera, and considering the condition the body was found in, who is preventing, who is hiding something that these records can't be found?
Well, you know, her family, her sister and her mother have all kinds of theories, but they have made attempts. Her sister has called out there. She has written out there. She has done everything but fly out there. And she, you know, and what we've been told, not by anybody in Las Vegas, but what we've been told by other people, you know, detectives and so forth, at this point in time, is the only thing left to do with this is to go through the state of Nevada and ask for a, what's that called, Freedom of Information Act.
Yes.
Yes. That's what we've been told, and that's what her sister is doing right now. There are no records.
Well, this is, I'm trying to find the right words. You have a deceased person who very well, I mean, may have been murdered, and no records apparently. This is just incredible to me. And
yeah.
I don't know where the blame lies or the fault lies, but my goodness. So we're unfortunately running out of time, but did you say that the sister is, in fact, going to do a Freedom of Information inquiry?
Yes, she is. Yes. Mm-hmm.
Well, Ben, what I'd like to do is, well, first I want to thank you for being with us. And secondly, please, will you let us know if anything changes on this? Because we really need, if there's anything additional, to follow up on this, because it really can't end here.
I understand that,
true.
Dennis.
True.
Yes, it can't end here. That's what our family's been saying for decades now. In fact, our two aunts, who are deceased today, spent many years calling and calling and calling. And they were the type of people that did not get on airplanes and fly all over the place. You know, so they didn't want to go out to Vegas. They didn't want to do that. But they made many phone calls, and every time they called out there, they were told that that she just died.
She just died.
She just died. And people die every day in Vegas.
Yeah.
So,
wow.
Yeah. It's,
okay. Well, listen, Doug, please keep in touch on this. Because, like
I will, Dennis, and thank you for having me.
And, again, the title of the book, Who Killed Chrissy? By Beverly Simcheck, available on Amazon. Please check it out. Yes, go ahead, Bev.
I was going to say it's Simcheck.
Simcheck, I'm sorry.
Simcheck.
Simcheck. Well, anyway, congratulations on the book, and thanks for spending your time with us today.
You're very welcome, and thanks so much for having me.
Okay, thanks, and thanks for the call, Manny.
Okay.
Thanks to our Director of Research, Kim Colton, and the Public Relations team with Delilah Jones at ImaginePublicity.com. Our next show will be Tuesday, March 19th at 7 p.m. Eastern. Tune in as we continue to analyze cases that wreak havoc on families looking for answers and seeking justice, and discuss crime-related topics with the experts. To hear a rebroadcast of the show, go to www.crimewire.blogspot.com. Turn on the volume at your computer, and the show will automatically play. Until next time, God bless and stay safe. And good night, Delilah. It was a pleasure working with you again.
Good night, Denny. It was great. And we'll have to do it again sometime.
Okay. Thanks, everybody. Bye-bye.